Public Purpose Conversations, brought to you by IPA Tasmania. Welcome to today's Public Purpose Conversations episode. My name is Mel Brown and I'm the current president of IPA Tasmania. Today, I'm lucky enough to be speaking to a key leader in the Tasmanian State Service. Jason Jacoby is the Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources and Environment Tasmania. Motivated by his love of the land, Jason's career journey has included over 25 years of senior executive experience in natural resource management in two of the country's most beautiful states, Queensland and right here in Tasmania. Jason, welcome.
Thank you, Mel. Really appreciate you having me on your podcast today.
Your commitment to public service is clearly reflected in your achievements across your career to date. You've been recognised with numerous awards in different parts of the country for your contribution to the emergency response efforts in the 2019-20 New South Wales bushfires, for your involvement in the Southeast Queensland flood relief and recovery efforts, and you're also an Australia Day Award recipient within the Queensland Public Service. You've clearly played a part in some incredibly challenging and interesting situations, and we're keen to hear from you about your personal journey today. You grew up in Queensland and spent a substantial amount of your earlier career in that part of the country before moving to Tasmania. Tell us about your early years and the inspirations and influences that led you towards a career in environmental management.
I've been incredibly fortunate in my career, Mel. When I look back on all the opportunities that I've had throughout my career in the Queensland Public Service, but also here in Tasmania, I'm a bit gobsmacked at just how lucky I have been. I've had the opportunity to work in some of the most amazing landscapes that Australia has to offer. And when I look back, I grew up on the foothills of Mount Cutha, just on the outskirts of Brisbane. It's not really a mountain if you try to compare it to the mountains down here in Tasmania, but I spent a lot of time in the bush. You know, I can remember fondly every afternoon after school, or walking to and from school through the bush and spending a lot of time in the bush building cubby houses and exploring. I got to know Mount Cutha very well. And the irony is that later on in my career, I actually was responsible for a lot of the bushland in that southeastern Queensland area. I think that love of the bush has carried me right through my career. I get a strong sense of belonging when I'm in amongst nature. I like exploring places, I like seeing new things, and bushwalking was just a huge passion of mine as I was growing up in the southeast Queensland corner. I spent huge amounts of time climbing Mount Barney and rock climbing on Mount French and exploring Main Range. And
sounds like every child's dream.
It was pretty good. And then, I studied in Queensland University of Technology. I always wanted to be a vet of all things as a child. I had a love for animals and I still do. I had read all the Harriet, novels and wanted to be a country vet.
Oh, James Harriet.
Yeah, yes. all the James Fantastic. Harriet novels. And but my student counsellor at the time said to me that my F marks for chemistry were just not going to land me in the university degree that I wanted. And he suggested to me, why don't you do this course? And it was a degree in landscape architecture and environmental planning at Queensland University of Technology, and it was a fairly new degree at that point in time. And I can remember saying to him, sounds all right, I was a 17-year-old kid. But it turned out to be one of the most amazing educational career opportunities that I had. I learned a lot from that degree, a lot about the sense of place and genius loci, it's commonly referred to as, and what makes a place significant to people and to the environment, and all of the concepts around design and the philosophy of design and integrating people's appreciation of the environment with the natural environment set a course for what's turned out to be an amazing career in natural resource management.
Indeed. Picking up on your reflections regarding the concept of sense of place, as you say, our relationships with the natural world and the spaces that we engage with can have a profound impact on the way that we feel and how we value the environment around us. I'd like to hear your thoughts about perhaps the contrasting sense of place that may have struck you in coming from a place like Queensland to a place like Tasmania.
The natural beauty of Tasmania is, there's just nothing like it, really. I had the opportunity of visiting and being responsible for some of the most amazing national parks that Queensland has to offer, from the Cape York Peninsula out to the Simpson Desert and the Western Deserts. right through to the, you know, mountains, as you can probably, you know, try and call them in Southeast Queensland. But a lot of the landscapes that I managed in Queensland were very flat. You know, they were moonscapes. As far as the eye could see, you could actually see the curvature of the earth when you look to the horizon. So the opportunity of coming to work in Tasmania in the Parks and Wildlife Service was a bit of a dream, really. You know, the Tasmanian Wilderness World Heritage Area is renowned globally as one of the most significant natural and cultural landscapes. So the opportunity to extend my professional experience from those moonscapes in Queensland to the Tasmanian environment was really an opportunity I just couldn't pass up.
Speaking of moonscapes and Queensland, your early career experiences back in that state were in landscape architecture. Where or when did the shift come for you in moving from working in the combined art and science of designing the outdoor environment to finding yourself in public service and public administration?
It was an unusual series of events. As soon as I left university, I worked for one of the largest landscape architectural companies in Queensland. They designed botanical gardens, native botanical gardens internationally. And so I had the opportunity to gain a really strong appreciation of native plant flora and also the principles of design. And I worked for them for a few years, and that was a great grounding in the profession. And then by chance, I ended up following my partner at the time to a small mining town called Mara in central Queensland. So I left the job in Brisbane and ended up in this very small rural mining community with no work. And I knocked on the door of the local council, which was Banana Shire Council, and said, have you got anything for a, you know, young landscape architect? And they offered me the opportunity to do a whole series of designs for all of their parks and recreation network in the community, not just Banana or Billawarra, I should say, but Theodore and Mara and all the other local townships. And before long, I think within 3 months, word got out that there was this young fella doing this sort of environmental planning, open space planning in central Queensland. And within a year, I had started up my own private practice. It was a partnership between myself and one of the local governments in the area. And I got to do private consultancy, but also to perform public service. I was the manager for parks and recreation. And I got to meld those, you know, the public service aspects of my life with the very creative private consultancy. And I had the most incredible experiences for close to 10 years working up and down the Queensland coast. And then a job came up as the principal landscape architect for the Queensland Parks and Wildlife Service. And that was the bastion of landscape architecture for me. It was the opportunity to work in the most pristine, beautiful places in Queensland and to influence the way in which people interacted with those landscapes. So I spent a couple of years as the principal landscape architect of the Queensland Parks and Wildlife Service, travelling all over the state, getting to do, you know, the most extraordinary design work in those environments, but also considering how best to protect the values of those places.
That's a big responsibility.
It was great. Yeah. It was an amazing opportunity. But I fell into then operational management, you know, managing pests, managing visitors, responding to fire became a real passion of mine, and I ended up in an operational stream, and that's pretty much led to where I am today.
What an interesting journey, and that clearly leaves you well placed to respond to my next question. What are your thoughts about how communities interact and engage with their local places and the natural environment, and about how we can ensure sustainable management practices? We know that the natural landscape and ecosystems can be pretty robust and self-sustaining, but that capacity is finite. A critical conversation for everyone should be about how we engage with our environment and its resources in ways that are, of course, fulfilling, that instill that sense of connection, place, and joy, but also ensure that our natural areas will be maintained for the future. What have you learned through your work in stewarding large-scale management approaches about how we instill a sense of stewardship in others for long-term benefit?
That's a big question. The greatest learning for me has been living in small communities, whether you consider Tasmania to be a small community or whether you consider a small rural mining town like Calliope or Mara in central Queensland to be a small community. Living in those environments with the people that survive and thrive in those areas, whether they're on a farm producing agricultural products or whether they're just living in a community and use the open spaces for recreation, you get a really strong appreciation about what people value and how they value natural areas for both its resource use but also for recreation. And I think over the course of my career and my life, having lived in those communities, I've really gained an appreciation about everybody has a different perspective about how that and the importance that they place on natural values and natural resources. Some people see it purely for the recreational aspects that it provides, whether that be hunting, camping, bushwalking, fishing. Other people see it from a very strong natural resource perspective in terms of that's where they might get their firewood from to survive. It might be a forest where they actually produce or take natural resources and produce materials and products from that. And also in my career, I have had a lot to do with Aboriginal people, and Aboriginal people value our natural landscapes and cultural landscapes differently to white fellas. And my involvement with Aboriginal people from the tip of Cape York to the Western Desert, the Simpson Desert, and the time that I've spent with them in that country and the opportunities I've had to help them to get land back under their stewardship has, I suppose, left me with a very strong sense about the value that people place on these natural landscapes and the role that we have in the public service to honour and recognise all of those values and to try and find the right balance between providing natural places for people but also for the plants and animals that exist there and for cultural use and enjoyment, but provide it in a way that strikes a balance between all of those different expectations and needs.
Very delicate balance. Just touching on your reflections with regards to working with Aboriginal Australians, we appreciate that Aboriginal Australians have been stewarding the land for thousands and thousands of years. What learnings from the way that Aboriginal people have managed that land do we still need to incorporate into contemporary natural resource management practices?
Look, I think that one of the most powerful things that I've taken from watching and living with and working with Aboriginal people on country is that their sense of place and their sense of culture and connection, trying to understand and appreciate, you know, 60,000 plus years of connection to country is very difficult for us as a European civilization. And, you know, a great example, I'll tell you a story of, I was at a land handback event where we were meeting with the Aboriginal community in Cape York, returning land that they'd been fighting for 40 years to have given back to them. And I was sitting in a seat with a couple of colleagues, and everybody in the community wanted to have a say about how significant this opportunity for getting the land back was to them. So we'd gone through, I think, 40 or 50, you know, speeches. And the person next to me said, "Oh, no, I'm not sure how much longer I can hang around for another speech." And I turned to him and just reminded him that, you know, they had been waiting 40 years for this event. So another couple of hours to sit here.
Seemed
quite a reasonable thing to do.
Very reasonable.
It's the long-term view that Aboriginal people have about their landscape, which always really strikes me as quite incredible. You know, that they are seeing things in hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands of years, whereas we often as land managers view things in much shorter spaces of time, 6 months or 12 months. And often that might reflect the political cycle of the funding that we've got or the program that we're delivering or the initiative that we've been asked and tasked to manage. So we're operating on very different timescales, and I think it's really important to always keep a long-term view.
That's a really good reflection, and I think it resonates in the context of everything seems faster. And just taking your point about timeframes, living in the here and now is a very short-sighted perspective, recognising those that have come before, the conversations, the stories, the history. It's very challenging in the here and now to work out what is a reasonable time frame for delivery of some things, particularly when you are talking about the land, which has been here for eons and has managed, in inverted commas, itself very well over those periods of time, albeit with flux and evolution.
I think patience has become one of my strengths, you know, that I have over the course of my career come to learn that when you're working with the landscape and you're working with nature, things can take a long time, that you need to have the patience to see projects through to their very end. And that might be decades before you actually realise the outcome. Often in public service, you know, we are working to very short, rapid timeframes. But when you look back and you look at some of the achievements that have been gained and delivered, sometimes over multiple decades, it's extraordinary when you look back and actually see how much has been achieved. At the time, it doesn't feel like it. And the public service feels like, you know, the wheels go round and round sometimes. But when you look back and you reflect, it's quite incredible what you can achieve in this sort of environment.
Recognising sometimes short-term imperatives are absolutely vital. And I'm thinking in the context of emergency management. You were involved in the Southeast Queensland flood recovery efforts. Tell me about that in terms of the role that you undertook and the engagement with a very challenged community. How do you manage that kind of crisis from a public perspective?
Look, the Southeast Queensland floods were unique. You know, the rainfall event that led to those floods unfolded over the course of several months, but then the actual flood event itself took, I think, close to a week to translate to flooding of people's houses. So the community in Southeast Queensland at the time, you know, knew this was coming. They had days in which to prepare, but no one, I think, really quite appreciated the scale and magnitude and the height of the flooding. So as people were being slowly inundated in Southeast Queensland and houses were going underwater, people were, I think, shocked at the scale and the extent of destruction that this flood event caused. And then equally, as slowly as the waters came up, they receded over the course of several days as well. And for that whole period of time, we weren't able to, no one could move. You couldn't get to any of these people to help them. And as soon as we had the opportunity to actually get into some of these communities, the disaster response was still in an evolutionary stage. People were still trying to work out, well, where do we send people? Who's the worst off? How do we deploy resources in such a constrained environment? And I was in an operational role responsible for a park on the Brisbane's outskirts, and we had a lot of ranger staff who were uniquely mobile. You know, they drove Land Cruiser four-wheel drives, they had fire units on the back of their vehicles, they had chainsaws, they were highly skilled and proficient at being remote and operating remotely for multiple days at a time. And we sent them to some areas that we knew other people weren't going to be able to get to, but they would, and they could. And they went in and just got about the business of helping and supporting people who were in a very dire situation. And the thing I learned about that was that that's exactly what the public service needs to be able to do. It needs to be able to respond quickly in an emergency. It needs to be agile. It needs to be able to adapt. You need people who are highly resourceful and capable. And that example of the Southeast Queensland floods, where our rangers just went into a community and did what they do best, which is help clean up and support the community to recover, was just a great example of how the public service can adapt and deploy very quickly and be incredibly resourceful in an emergency situation.
You've worked obviously in the Parks and Wildlife Services for a substantial part of your career, which I think in some ways is lovely because it's dovetailing the flora and fauna, recognising that you didn't go down the vet path, but you still get to work in a space where you've got contact and engagement with those animals. You decided to move from the flat areas of Queensland, not that it's all flat, but to certainly a different topographical region in the Antipodes. What catalysed that move?
I've been in the public service in Queensland for 20 years, and I had the privilege of visiting every single corner of Queensland. I'd been from the tip of Cape York to the Simpson Desert in the west, been responsible for the Southeast Queensland highly urbanised corner. I'd had the opportunity of acting in a number of different roles. I was responsible for threatened species, for strategy and planning in the Parks and Wildlife Service. And the opportunity to come to Tasmania and to operate and be responsible for a completely different environment was unique. And who wouldn't want to live down here? I mean, Tasmania is just one of the most beautiful places in the world to live and to work. And the opportunity of being involved in the management of places like the Tasmanian Wilderness World Heritage Area and some of the extraordinary other landscapes that we have, like Macquarie Island to the south, was an opportunity or a chance that I couldn't pass up. But the irony is that, you know, whilst the landscape is very different. Some things are very similar. Fire management up north on the mainland is not that different to down here. The flames down here can be, and the trees are a little bit bigger, so sometimes the fires are a lot larger than I was used to. You know, burning a savannah plain in Queensland is very different to seeing a tall forest down here under wildfire conditions, but also drought. You know, in Queensland, I was in 2014, I can remember that very clearly. I spent months sitting around landholders' kitchen tables talking to them about the drought they were going through, about opening up protected areas for cattle grazing, which is an extraordinary thing to have to ever consider. And I never thought in my career I would have ever had to have contemplated making a national park available for cattle grazing. But it was, again, adapting and being flexible and responsive to the needs of a community at a particular point in time. And we actually changed the legislation overnight to enable some of our protected areas to be accessed by cattle for grazing, which is an extraordinary thing, almost unheard of in a protected area management sense. But we put time limits on those conditions. We set the legislation so that it could only occur for that specific activity. And we also used it to help control buffel grass, which is a pasture type that you don't particularly want in national parks. So it had a twofold benefit. And the creativity behind that solution that helped the community but also helped reduce fuel on national parks in central Queensland was a pretty great thing to be involved in when I look back. But we've also, in Tasmania, we've experienced some of the worst drought conditions in over 50 years. King and Flinders Island have been subject to extraordinary dry conditions. So has a lot of mainland Tasmania. But the team that I'm responsible for here in the department, they have been amazing in how they've responded to the community. They've spent time working with landholders, farmers, to help them to navigate an extremely difficult time. And the agility and the adaptability of the public service here in Tasmania just reminds me of why working in government is a very rewarding career.
Tell us about your career progression to the very broad role of acting as secretary.
I've always felt that it's important to hang around in a job long enough to be responsible for the decisions that you make. There's nothing worse than somebody making a decision and then moving on and you get left with either a decision that isn't going to work or a decision that you have to make work. So I felt very strongly about it's good to be in a role long enough that you actually have to live with your decisions. But I've also felt in my career that it's good to change. You know, after a period of time, you need to move on. You need to provide space for growth in the organisation and for somebody with a fresh set of eyes to step into the role and just see things and do things differently to the way that you have. That's healthy in not just the public service, but probably in any organisation, in my opinion.
Any walk of life, yeah.
You know, in my career, if you'd said to me 40 years ago I was going to be in senior roles in parks and wildlife, I would have never have thought that possible, let alone even if you'd said to me 5 years ago when I came down to Tasmania that one day I might be the secretary of the department, I would have probably laughed you out of the room. But again, when an opportunity arises and a door opens, sometimes the time is right and sometimes it's not right. And I had a couple of cracks at the secretary role here in this department, relieving in it. And deliberately chose not to take the job or to apply for it. I didn't think I was quite ready for it. And you have to, I think, feel emotionally and mentally ready for a role sometimes before you take it on. And the opportunities that I had to test myself and my leadership style and capability in the role prior to applying for it was really important because I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about my leadership style and I learned a lot about what I might be capable of. So when I was actually offered the role and given the opportunity of being the secretary of the department, I was surprised, very humbled, but I feel incredibly privileged to be able to lead such a diverse organisation responsible for so much of this state. And I'm incredibly blessed to have an amazing team, both my executive, but the whole of the department is just a very passionate group of people committed to what they're doing and who genuinely believe, like I do, that we can really make a difference in the public service.
It is very important to surround yourself with good, passionate people, isn't it? Because we can't do it alone.
It's definitely not about me. It's about the people that I work with that makes this place tick and that delivers the success that we all want to see.
How do you balance the work that you do in terms of administration, and particularly at a very senior level, how do you remain in touch to be able to ensure that you're making really good decisions?
That's a good question. The work that I do in the department now is very much about strategy and policy and designing policy solutions to problems. So, you know, whilst I've come from an operational grassroots background, I suppose that has been very helpful in that when you design a policy solution, you actually have to know how does it play out in practice. You know, it's all very well to sit at a desk and think of a policy solution to a problem, but if it's not actually going to roll out in a way that supports the community and delivers public value, then you may as well go home. And having an operational background, I think, brings a really clear understanding about, well, what can I do in a policy sense that will have practical outcomes on the ground? I've always been very hands-on in my career, and I've always had a very strong interest in people. And I think you should never lose sight of that in the public service. No matter who you're dealing with, the individual has an opinion and a view on how things should be done. And it's really important to stay connected with that. The only way to really stay connected to the community is to spend time with them, to breathe the air that they're breathing in, to walk in their shoes, to understand the problem. And that actually means getting out of the office and being with them on the ground, kicking the dirt, talking about the challenges that they're facing and understanding what's really affecting them. And I think that connection with the community on the ground at the coalface is absolutely critical. No matter what role you are in any public service environment, you have to stay connected. And the best way to do that is to stay connected face to face. I have a philosophy that if you're communicating with your clients and stakeholders, you try and do that face-to-face first and foremost, and you only revert to a phone call or email or written communication when you absolutely have to. There's nothing better than walking the talk on the ground with people on the land that they're responsible for.
What are your thoughts regarding the challenges and opportunities of managing our natural values and heritage areas here in Tasmania? What are the key principles that apply from your perspective as a leader in the agency tasked with protecting our beautiful flora and fauna? What do we do well? What can we do better? What can we learn from others or share with others about the way that we do things here?
Whether it's fisheries management or forestry or protection of our natural areas, I've always felt very strongly about evidence-based science informing our decisions, that collecting data and understanding and researching the impacts of that data on your actions is critical to making the right decisions. And sometimes intervening in the way in which nature works is not always the best scenario. That, you know, I've learned over the course of my career that no matter how many resources you might have at your disposal, no matter how much science you have to inform your decision makings, nature will often throw a curveball and decide for itself how it will manage the landscape for you. You know, the catastrophic wildfires that we had in 2019 here in Tasmania transformed much of the Tasmania Wilderness World Heritage Area. And, you know, we threw all the resources that we had at that event, but at the end of the day, it was a large-scale fire event that lasted 4 months. It was a natural event, you know, caused by lightning strikes, and we just now have to work with the landscape to help it to recover. I've always felt very strongly too about the sustainability of use of natural resources. You know, that all of the natural areas that we manage, whether it's the marine environment or the land, very often impacts are connected with people. You know, the numbers of people using them, the way in which they take those resources and use them critically impacts on the sustainability of those values. And it all boils down to how do we manage that resource use or that resource enjoyment in a way which maintains a long-term sustainable view. And that's pretty much what the Department of Natural Resources and Environment is all about. It's about sustainable use of Tasmania's landscapes and resources.
Fantastic. And it does a wonderful job of that, obviously covering an enormous remit of responsibilities. I want to talk about how you bring an organisation as diverse as this agency along with your leadership values and your leadership views and your ideas about the priorities that need to be put first. What are your thoughts and reflections in relation to how you bring people along with you on a very big agenda?
You'll often hear people talk about authentic leadership and authenticity in the way in which you relate to people. I also like to think of it as felt leadership. It's the emotion that you bring to the role and your understanding and empathy and respect for the people that you work alongside and that you work with. That has always been fundamentally important to me in terms of the way I operate. I'm inquisitive about the people that I work with. I want to know what makes them tick. I want to understand what their values are, what drives them. And I want to provide an environment where they want to continue to thrive. And that's always been a principle that I've taken with me throughout my career. I take a direct interest in people. I want to know where they've come from, what their aspirations are. And we're very fortunate in this department. We have a lot of people who work for us who are passionate about the environment, whether it's the marine environment or land or agriculture or biosecurity. They all work with us for a reason. They are passionate about protecting the sustainability of Tasmania, and you couldn't ask for anything more than that. Being seen, I think, is really important. When you're in a leadership role, if you're hidden away and no one knows who you are or what makes you tick or what drives you, then it's very hard to understand what the strategy or the direction of the organisation is. So I like to spend a lot of time out on the ground, much like I do with stakeholders and clients, understanding them, understanding the environment that they're operating in, learning from them about some of the challenges that they face, and that informs the decisions that I make every day. If you understand the people that you work with and the challenges that they face in their working environment, you can make decisions which hopefully make that much better for them.
This agency is making a really positive and proactive effort to ensure that career opportunities within natural resource and environmental management are pathways that everyone sees as being available to them and appealing to them. And as people progress in their career path or they're aspiring to do something as a young person, they want to be able to see the role models. They want to be able to actually understand that there's a pathway for them. What sorts of programs have you got in place in the context of attracting the right skill sets and the right mix of professionals into this agency?
We have an aging workforce here in Tasmania. You know, people who've joined this organisation have stuck with it. They've been here for, you know, decades because they're passionate about what they do and they love the work that they do. But you've always got to be thinking about, well, what does the future hold for this organisation? How do we attract and retain new blood? How do we build the workforce for the next 50 years? So having a really strong succession plan is important. And the See It, Dream It, Do It program that we initiated close to 5 years ago was all about how do we make jobs in NRE TAS and at the time in the Parks and Wildlife Service, how do we attract young people to those roles? How do we build a career in land management and land stewardship that makes people want to come and join our organisation? The See It, Dream It, Do It program really was about targeting women in the workforce because we recognised at the time that we had a very male-orientated operational workforce and that we needed to find ways for women to see a career pathway in the organisation. That's been incredibly successful. And, you know, now in the department we have close to 50% female representation across the entire organisation. We've got an executive board of this department which is 80% female, and we've got close to, I think, 67% of senior leaders in our organisation are women. And that's been a huge turnaround in the last 5 years.
Clearly, you can see an evidence base there to hark on one of your earlier references. I appreciate in Tasmania, we need to probably think about the context that we work within in comparison to other jurisdictions. What do you consider are the key opportunities and challenges associated with operating a public sector agency in Tassie?
I think the opportunities in Tasmania are that we are so connected with each other in our communities. It's much smaller than other states, and you know, the ability to connect with somebody just seems to be a lot easier down here. And in a lot of ways, that enables you to get things done quicker. Whereas, you know, I can remember in the Queensland Public Service, you know, nobody would have known who the minister was, let alone who the head of the department was. Whereas down here, because of the size and scale, your role and your responsibilities just seem to be much more prominent. And I think that applies to all of our staff, that they're very prominent in their roles, they're known in their communities, they're connected with the people that they work with, and that, in a lot of ways, the opportunity is that facilitates things being able to get done faster. That's a huge opportunity. One of the challenges that we have is attracting and retaining people. you know, whilst Tasmania is an extraordinary place to live and work, the big city bright lights always tends to draw people to jobs that are maybe perhaps better paying, and that's constantly a challenge. So keeping people in roles down here has always been a really difficult thing to do. But some of the programs we've got operating, the diversity and inclusion programs that we have in my department, are really paying dividends in terms of attracting people to Tasmania, selling the benefits of the lifestyle, but also selling the advantages of the strategic work that they do. People have demonstrated in the state service survey that we recently completed, people have clearly articulated that they connect with our strategy and our purpose. They understand why we're here, and they have committed to that purpose. And that's a really great thing, that people want to work for this organisation, they want to deliver a sustainable Tasmania, and they want to live and breathe the purpose of the agency.
It's a great place to live, work and play, I think is one of the most fantastic attractions that this state can possibly offer in terms of getting people, good people like yourself, to actually come down for air, as they say, and enjoy the spaces and places. What are your favourite places in Tassie and your favourite, you know, harking back to your veterinary aspirations from your earlier career days, what are your favourite animals, the things that really allow you to identify with the state and are endearing to you?
My favourite places, there's always a risk when you tell somebody about your favourite place that it's going to become more popular than you would like. But I'd have to say that the Western Arthurs in the Tasmanian Wilderness World Heritage Area is a place that I'm very connected with. I can remember as a 16-year-old boy in Queensland, a mate and I planned to walk the Western Arthurs, and we spent 3 months planning this trip. And that was back in the early 80s. So it was a long way away for a couple of teenagers. We never made it back then, but I can remember ever since I landed here, you know, 8 years ago, doing the Western Arthurs was going to be my bucket list achievement.
Right.
I had the pleasure of going in there about 3 years ago and getting pushed out by a severe weather event, having walked 3 days in, having to do 3 days and come back out, and then the following year managed to do the whole traverse, and it was just...
Oh, well done.
It ticked all of the boxes. It was just one of those most amazing experiences that I'll never forget. So I'd have to say that's one of my favourite places in Tassie. In terms of flora and fauna, you know, in terms of flora, you just can't beat the Tasmanian waratah, one of the most spectacular plants I think I've ever seen, and it's like a Christmas tree when you see it in flower. And I've got a bit of a soft spot for wombats. You know, one of the first parks I had the pleasure of visiting when I first came here was Morara Island. To step off the boat in a World Heritage area with the history of that place, but then to be surrounded by wildlife and wombats crawling over the hillside. It's a moment I'll never forget.
Fantastic. So from the west coast to the east, it sounds like Tasmania's in very good hands. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate you being able to give us an insight into the life and the career that you have had to date.
Thanks, Mel. I never in my career thought I would be in a role like this. You know, if you'd asked me 30 years ago or 40 years ago that I was one day going to be the secretary of this department, I never would have thought that possible. But it just goes to show that, you know, doors open and opportunities come along. And if you work hard and remain committed to the cause, then there's every chance that anyone in the public service could be in any role that appeals to them.
If you were harking back to provide some advice or write a letter to your younger self, be it career advice, life advice, what are the sorts of things that you would like to be able to tell your younger self to set them on the right pathway?
Go with your gut instinct. If I had one piece of advice to myself or to anybody, is that often your gut will tell you exactly what is the right decision, and you'll know when you've made that decision that it was right, or you'll know that it was the wrong decision. Throughout my entire career, I have been very much often influenced by what my brain is telling me, but often I go with my gut, because time and time again, it's spoken the truth. It's led me down different roads that I probably wouldn't have gone down if I'd thought about it too much. And it's always landed me in the right place. And I'm a bit of a believer in fate. I've never done a job for the money. I've never done it for the profile or the recognition. I've done the job because I've wanted to do it. I've got a very strong public service commitment and value and a strong connection to community. And I love working with people. And that has always often driven my decisions. And fortunately, fate has often landed me in the right place at the right time.
It sounds very much like you are the right person in the right place at the right time for the job that you're doing.
I'm very lucky,
yes.
Very lucky.
Again, really appreciate you spending some time today to talk about those sorts of reflections and give us an insight into the career that you've had and the contribution that you're clearly making, both to our natural environment but also to public service. So thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you, Mel. It's been a lot of fun.
Cheers.
Brought to you by IPA Tasmania. This podcast was recorded on the traditional lands of the Muwinina people under the slopes of Kunanya Mount Wellington in Nipaluna, Hobart. We pay our respects to all Aboriginal people and recognise the ongoing custodianship of the Palawa people across the island of Lutruwita, Tasmania.